on life cycles. So I've never really taught here as a unit. So I think we broke it up into birth, marriage, and death. Was there something else? Was there a fourth unit? I forgot. Do anyone remember?
Yeah, come
on. You want to check real quick? Thanks. And then we run out of. And then we're done with this section. So we need some more ideas. So, any ideas for new topics?
What would you think? Are you including bar mitzvahs? Probably.
Yeah. Let me. Neil's gonna check. I forgot if we put
it. Life cycles or
no? Totally new stuff. After life cycles.
Birth, growing up, then marriage and death.
Growing up. What did I mean by that, Neil?
I guess this was mine.
Whose idea was this life cycle? So someone's idea.
Okay, here it is. So birth, baby namings versus picking up.
Okay.
Growing up of Sharon's bar mitzvah.
Okay,
marriage,
fine.
And death.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. So next week will be up Sharon's bar mitzvahs. Okay.
There's four classes. Basically four classes.
Yeah. No, and then marriage, and then I give you the marriage and divorce if you want to throw a divorce in for those interested in how that works. And then we could do death. Okay. I'll keep us busy. Okay, so today is birth. So after that I need new ideas. I mean, we're still a month before Purim, so it's a little early. A month of Purim seems like a lot. So I don't know if we could do that. Any ideas?
You mean after these four classes, we'll be a month from
Purim? Yeah, maybe we'll do the vices. What?
After these four classes, you'll be a month from Purim.
Gambling.
It'll be February. Right? These classes cover January.
Yeah.
So then we'll have February, and then with Purim, and then into Pesach. So if we did three, could we do 3 weeks on vices? What if we had gambling?
Drugs.
Gambling, drugs, alcohol, and smoking, maybe? Is there a third one we could throw in there?
Is there a distinction between smoking tobacco and smoking marijuana?
Yeah, I would put it into one section. We could discuss potential differences. Ramosha has a tshuva on smoking marijuana. Smoking cigarettes is probably the best example. Most prevalent, but yeah.
You said there was a rabbi who did tshuva on smoking marijuana?
No, I don't mean like the tshuva. He wrote a tshuva means like a responsa.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm sure there's many rabbis who've done tshuva on smoking marijuana, but that's not what I meant.
Someone asked him if smoking marijuana was permitted?
Yeah, he's a written tshuva. Yeah, written responsa about
the. What was his answer?
Well, I can't give it away now.
Oh,
you won't come to my classes.
Class.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so we've got. Okay.
You have to be born before you can smoke.
Right.
That's true.
Fine, so
Unless the mother smokes. So
maybe we'll do 2 weeks on vices and 2 weeks on Purim. That we could do. Okay, I'm kind of really getting into Purim already in a weird way. Because I got so into like the history of Hanukkah and Alexander the Great that now I'm like getting really into the Persian Empire and what it was about. We could do two-part series on the Persian Empire. The real question is in the story of Purim. We have a hard time placing historically when exactly takes place within the Persian Empire. There's kind of disputes, and there's like the Talmud's opinion on it, and then there's the scholars, the modern day scholars, the historical scholars, and most historical scholars don't agree with the Talmud's account of when the story actually happened. So there's a lot of stuff there.
Yeah, there's 6 weeks on Wednesdays.
Between now and...
Between February and Purim.
No, and Purim is the first week of March.
But there are five Wednesdays.
Five Wednesdays between...
The Jewish calendars. Yeah, I just happen to have one with
me. Oh, there's five Wednesdays. Oh, there's five Wednesdays in February. That's what it is. Ah, I see.
And then the fast of us.
How does that work in February?
What?
How does that work in February?
There's 29 days of February. The first and the 29th are Wednesdays.
Okay.
So we're maximizing our Wednesdays in February. Okay, that works. And then the 7th, the next Wednesday, is Purim night already. Purim is Wednesday night. So we're not going to class then anyway. Okay, so we need a third vice. A third vice or a third class on Purim, one or the other, to make it work. So if you think of any other vices, let me know.
Well, I don't know, maybe this kind of relates a little bit to Purim.
Shopping?
Yeah, shopaholics.
Okay, I'm sorry?
Halakha and secular law or secular rulings.
For what?
Oh, Dina de Machuta Dina,
I don't know if there's enough for a whole separate class on that. But the, with the secular rulers, that does relate a little bit to Quran.
Are you obligated to follow the secular laws of the land or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah, and what...
not drive drunk after permit.
Well, that's a safety issue, also, yeah.
Yeah, it's also
legal. Okay, no, I can, I've taught that before. I could teach a class about that.
Or what types of obedience and allegiance is owed to a secular ruler more than looks
of it. Okay, I like that, because that's part of the problem of Purim. Oh, I like that. Yeah, we could do that.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. Gang, I'm good idea. So that will be okay. I'll figure out exactly how to set up the schedule. But can we get a whole class on gambling? That's my only question. We probably can. I might have to spend some time teaching everyone how to play blackjack, if that's okay. And we'll learn the odds and everything.
Okay. I already know.
So that's where you were.
Then we'll just play.
What? That's where you got your money, blackjack?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the only way. Yeah. I don't play slots. I don't know. It seems like a waste of time.
Find any good points how you play?
No, they didn't go with me. I'm with my father-in-law. He likes to play, so I kept him company. We did well.
Play.
What?
You said you won. I mean, you play.
I did play. We went together. Yeah, no, we played.
The children were doing other things.
They were asleep. Well, we only went out at night when they were asleep.
They were
asleep.
Learning.
they're not Bitteltor. Okay, let's get to our topic tonight. So our topic tonight is birth. So, I taught classes 2 years ago when we were doing our mitzvah of the week. We did a class on Bris Milah, and we did a class on Pidyon HaBen. So, we'll talk about that a little bit, but since we did do that already, and it's already up on YU Torah, so the class is there for perpetuity. So, we'll talk about it, but I'm going to start talking more about names. You know, Jewish names have a very kind of important place in our tradition. And people take it very, very seriously. And the Talmud... The Talmud makes a comment in Brachos Zayin Amud Bet 7b that a person's name... Okay. This is where it starts. Okay, so the Talmud's talking about the names of the tribes, right? Because the Torah gets into the details of how they're given their names, right? So Reuven gets his name, and Levi gets his name, and Shimon, Levi, and Yehuda, and we're given the details as to how they get their names. So obviously, we take pretty seriously, you know, this name-giving process. So the Gemara then says... Sorry. So, from where do we know that a name is the cause of future occurrences? The Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer says, for the verse states, go and see the works of God who has wrought devastations in the land. Don't pronounce the name Shemot as in devastations, rather pronounce it as names. This is a verse from Psalms, Tehillim 46:9. Another statement, Rabbi Yochanan said, a degenerate child in a person's home is an affliction more than the future war of Gog and Magog. Okay, we'll just skip this a little bit. So, the Gemara says that a name is a part of a person's kind of a part of their future.
Only a Jewish name? Or
their Jewish name, yeah.
If a Jew is named Scott, does that have any significance?
That does not seem to be what it's talking about. Yeah. Does not seem to be what it's talking about.
You're talking about Hebrew names.
Talking about Hebrew names, right. So even the name Ruth, for example, which is an interesting example, though, because Ruth the Moabite, what is significant to the name Ruth? Rabbi Yochanan says, for she married that David descended from her, who sated the Holy One, blessed be He, with songs and praises. So, and there's it's a play on the name Ruth. So Ruth, who was not born Jewish, and whose name could not have been a Jewish name, because why would her parents give her a Jewish name? So there's an example, though, that becomes a Jewish name. And it seems that within her name, her parents had some sort of prophecy or whatever it is to give her this name, because it was going to allude to the fact that her descendant David would write Tehillim and write Psalms. So there's these references to a name being relevant and somehow affecting a child's future. Now, it's not that you give a child a name and then it automatically determines their future, but it does seem to have some sort of relevance to their character, to their very being. However, today it is different than in the Torah, because if we look at the Torah, they don't name after each other, right? Yaakov is not given the name of his grandfather, right? Yaakov doesn't name any of his sons Abraham, right? Why not? If we name after those who passed on, then why doesn't Yaakov name any of his 12 sons Abraham or Yitzchak? He names them. Yitzchak was still alive.
They all were born before he died.
Before Yitzchak died, not Abraham, right? So why doesn't Yaakov name any 12 tribes? How do they figure out their names? Their names are made up, right? They make up names based on their life situations. So, and that's how they do it. And that changes later on. But we don't see any repetition of names, right? The tribes' names don't become, you know, when we get the lineages of the tribes later on and their descendants, it's not like you got a bunch of people in the tribe of Levi named Levi or a bunch of people in the town of tribe of Judah named Yehuda. That happens much later on, that we begin to name after the deceased. And some say it's because there was some sort of Ruach HaKodesh, some level of prophecy people had or felt they had to kind of come up with names that fit their circumstances. But names were personal. They were very, very personal. And they were made for the situation that you were in. And even in the times of the prophets, we see that, right? A lot of the stories in the prophets of children being named or being born, they're given names that are reflective of their situation. Desperation, thanking God, things like that. But we don't really see names being reused until later on. But then by the time we're into the times of the Mishnah and the Talmud, so we see that all the time, right? Some of the names are Aramaic, and some of the names are very common names that we'll see, you know, Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi, you know, Levi. So by the times of the Mishnah and the Talmud, which is already the Second Temple period, we see a lot of names coming back. And now they're using, by the Second Temple period, we're seeing more and more they're using biblical names. Right? So it seems this transition seems to happen around the time of the Second Temple period, which is around the time when prophecy ends. So it seems that is a transition that happens. But even in the earlier prophets, we don't see a lot of names being... We see some names being used over and over. And there was a King Menashe. There were certain names that were used repetitively. But many of the names were not. Right? Many of the names were original names or not traced back to any great sage in Jewish life. Okay. We should also note that there's a lot of people in Jewish tradition that are given non-Hebrew names, right? Aramaic names were, right? Many of the names in Babylonia were Aramaic names. The story of Hanukkah is full of very religious Jews who have Greek names, right? It was very common. And that happened throughout, you know, and then Yiddish names become very popular, even though Yiddish is, you know, a German-Hebrew hybrid. But still, there's a lot of German to it, and a lot of Yiddish names have a lot of German in it.
I have a Yiddish name.
Right. So it's not like Jews have felt compelled to limit themselves to Hebrew names throughout our history. If anything, now I think we've come back to Hebrew names more than
in Egypt, they used strictly Hebrew names.
Right. That's a good point. So when the Jews were in Egypt, one of the ways that they're saved is because they used Jewish names and didn't adopt. They have Hebrew names as opposed to Egyptian names. Right. That's true. Right. And that's seen as one. Oh God, that's a pretty cute jacket there, I gotta say.
I think my daughters would really think that this is a great fashion.
Oh, they'd be all over it. Oh, they'd love it. Is that what you're saying?
Were Ephraim and Manasseh Hebrew names? Or did they become Hebrew names later?
They are for Hebrew lettering. Let's see, what's the forgot about this.
Hebrew lettering, it was written in Hebrew.
It was last week's question, right? There you go. No, it's Mikael, sorry. Okay, let's go through inside. Alright, well, Yosef yulad shnei banim, b'terem tavoshna terav, asher yalda lo asnat bat potifar kohenom, b'ger Yosef et shem ha-bechor menashe, kinashani alokim et kol malai, et kol beit aviv, et hasheni, shem hasheni kara Ephraim, ki hifrani Elohim be'eretz anyi. Right, so... Joseph called the name of his firstborn Menashe, for God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's household. And then his second son is called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. So, right. So they're both Hebrew, which I don't know how he pulls off pretending to be an Egyptian when he gives his kids names based on Hebrew words.
Were those his public names in the
story? Yeah. We don't see any other names for them. I don't know if he has a way of making them sound Egyptian. I don't know. But he gives them Hebrew names. He gives them names based on Hebrew. But again, he makes these names up. Right? These names are based on his very personal circumstances, right?
Didn't the Egyptians know he was Hebrew? So, like, he could have passed that off that way?
Yeah, they knew he was Hebrew.
Right. I guess, yeah, no, they already knew. That's true. He keeps saying, my God. Yeah, that's true. They didn't want to sit with it. Yeah, that's true. They didn't know he was Hebrew. So that's true. No, you're right. That's true.
What about Hagar's second name? She goes by. Is that a Hebrew name?
Keturah.
Yeah.
Do we find out where it's based on? Let's check.
That sounds very close to Keturah.
Very good. That's also part of Sarah, right?
I believe it's the end of. Yeah, here it is. Page 121. Keturah.
Ketubah is really with a different letter.
Oh, okay.
Ketubah is with a test.
Here, so Rashi says Keturah zo hagav negas Keturah al shem shinayim masike ketoret. That her actions are as beautiful as the incense. So it's based on Hebrew lettering. Yeah. That's from the Midrash. So it's based on Hebrew words, yeah. It's based on the incense. So, but again, these names are all made up, right? These names are made up. Yosef doesn't name his kids Avraham or Yitzchak or Terach or Noach or Adam or anything like that. He names his kids very personal things, right? God made me forget all my hardship and all my father's household. God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. All relate to his personal circumstances, right? And like we said, Leah names her kids Reuven. It's all, you know, now my husband won't hate me. Now maybe my husband will like me. Now maybe my husband won't, will say hi to me in this, you know. So, right? They're very, very personal names. So, that's the first thing. Is that change seems to happen around the time of the Second Temple. Nowadays, it's become the custom to name after a relative who's passed on, for the most part.
Sfarim do the opposite.
Sfarim still name, they still name after people, but they can be alive. Right. But if you look into Jewish law, there's nowhere in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, does it say, you know, here is how you should determine how to name your child. Right? There's not like a system of first comes the grandparent, then comes the great-grandparents, anything like that. It's really based on custom. And a lot of it's personal choice. So we have some kind of thing, some guidelines or some certain customs, but there's not strict law as to what to name your child after. Okay, so first question. Who gets to name the child? Okay? The mother or the father? Let's say there's a disagreement. Who gets final call?
The woman, because she has to give birth to it.
Okay. So here it seems as there's a difference in custom. Svaradim, if you want to guess, Svaradim, who gets to name
father.
It?
Father.
What?
Period.
Okay. And Ashkenazim, who gets to name it?
The mother,
exactly. So, as you would expect, I'll put it this way, the first child. No one says that one parent gets every naming, but as far as the initial child, Svaradim, the custom is the father's side gets the first name, and Ashkenazim, the custom is the mother's side gets the first name, but then usually it switches, right? At some point they come back to it. So, why is that? So, it's interesting that different Svaradic Poskim give a reason for it, and Ashkenazim they give reasons why the mother's side. So they each have their own kind of sources. So Rav Avada Yosef, who's the renowned head, major Posek of the Sephardic community, who's still alive today in his 90s, I believe. So he quotes the story of Yehuda and his wife. So we're back in Parshat Vayeshev. And what happens here? So, when they have their children, Vatar Vatele Ben Vatikra et Shemo Er, Vatar O Vatele Ben Vatikra et Shemo Onan. Vatase Vatele Ben Vatikra et Shemo Shela, Vaybekizvid Bileda Taoto. Okay. So, it was at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned away towards Nazarite man, his name was Hira. Then there Judah saw the daughter of a prominent merchant whose name was Shua. He married her, concerned with her. She conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Er. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. Okay, so he names the first child, and she names the second one. So, Rav Avad Yosef wants to say, we see from here that the proper custom is that the father names the first child, the mother names the second. I mean, it comes from his side of the family, then her side of the family. I'm not so sure how much we want to copy Judah's sons as the ultimate example of what we should do in life. And you can go exactly. You can go. You look at Leah's kids, and Leah names all the kids. Leah is the one who names them, so that would seem to imply the mother is first. So it's somewhat arbitrary, possibly. There's the Ben Ish Chai, who says something wild, but I'll say it because it's so wild. So he says, Nadav and Avihu, okay? Nadav and Avihu, the two sons of Aaron, who died suddenly when they went into the temple when they shouldn't have, to the Mishkan when they shouldn't have. So the Midrash learns out that Nadav and Avihu were based on names from the mother's side. And he wants to say one of the reasons they died young is because they were improperly named from their mother's side. They should be named from their father's side. That's what he says. That's crazy. But all right. It's interesting. So that is the Sephardic approach. Ashkenazim say no. They say that really it's based on the mother's side. So two reasons given that I saw that were interesting. Number one, from a Sefer called the Otzir Yerushalayim, says that the custom was that the bride's father was the one expected to support the couple in their beginning years. So, hey, if her side's supporting the family, the couple, they get to name, the first child gets named after them, after their side. Another, the Kesser Ephraim says that in many ways the bride has to kind of subjugate herself more than the husband does. She has to, change her name. She moves into kind of the husband's home. There's more of a separation from her family in that sense. So therefore, as a way of keeping the family connected to the mother's side, they felt that the first child should get the mother's side should get the first name to make sure the family and the couple feels connected to the mother's side and not just to the father's side, not to the groom's side. So a few different reasons given. But it's interesting to see how it kind of shakes out. But yeah, in a Sephardi an Asfardic couple, if it's a firstborn boy, you can guarantee that it's going to be named after, you know, the paternal grandfather, even if he's alive, right? That's like a given. So that always happens. Okay.
So about Moshe and Aaron, Moshe was named by Paro, right?
Moshe is by Paro's daughter.
By Paro's daughter. And so what about, who named Aaron?
His parents.
Well, I mean, is it based from his mother, or his father? Do we know?
And the Torah doesn't give us Aaron's birth and his how he gets his name. There's only certain people that the Torah tells us, you know, when they're born, how they got their name. Sometimes we just get their name, right? Mm-hmm. And we don't know why. That's a lot of names.
What you just said makes me wonder if my father's side is Sephardic, because they're dark. And I was named after my father's mother, who was alive. Her name was Leah. But my mother's side was definitely Ashkenazi, so they didn't want to name me Leah. They named me something else, but they named me Linda.
So that's a very Sephardic thing to do, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, yeah, that's a very Sephardic approach, for sure.
Ancestry.com. Huh? Ancestry.com.
That's, you know, you can't really get anywhere because they came over here in 1917 after one of the purges from Russia. So, yep. You know, things are lost in antiquity.
But one thing is clear, it's that the naming of the child is the parents' prerogative. And it's interesting that, you know, the grandparents tend to get very involved with the naming of the children. Because very often the child's going to be named after one of the child's great-grandparents, right? Which means one of the grandparents' parents. So very often there's jockeying for naming rights, especially amongst the first grandkids. Everyone's, you know, naming after my father, after my mother, and there's a lot of that going on. And especially the first grandchild, you know, family, you know, the parents are a lot of jockeying for position. So ultimately it comes down to the parents, their prerogative, not the grandparents' prerogative. But that doesn't always happen. Yeah. Okay. What about names that should not be given? So there is a custom not to name a child after a rasha, someone who's wicked. And that's one of the sources, the Talmud in Yoma 38b, Lamed Ches Amud Beis, says that the name of the wicked shall rot. And what does that mean? That means that we shall try to remove the names of wicked people. So partly that means that we don't use wicked people in the Torah's names as names, right? So we don't use Esav, and we don't use Haman, and we don't use, Bilam, and all these Balak. These don't become Jewish names. But there is some ambiguity, because there's some people that some might consider to be evil, and yet Yishmael, for example. So Yishmael became a Jewish name, right? And even though he wasn't a hero in the Torah, he does repent, he's not seen as nearly as wicked as Esav was, and he becomes a Jewish name.
Yitro,
who's not a wicked person. We don't really see his name.
Jethro.
Yeah, well, in English for sure. Yeah, English for sure. But in Hebrew,
that's amongst Jews, is it?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think you really see it. What'd you say?
Okay.
Yeah. But we don't see Hevel either. We don't see either one of them. They don't really become Adam and Chava become Jewish names. Okay. Right, yeah. Cain and Hevel, Cain and Abel are never really used as Jewish names. Noach is a Jewish name, right?
It is?
Yeah, Noah, yeah, for sure.
And Cain's name in Hebrew is Lavan.
Is Lavan?
Really?
Lavan.
That's pretty rare.
Wow.
So your parents don't like it?
What kind of
Lavan?
Person is your cousin?
Yeah, no, right?
Lavan?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty rare. But look, you pick any Torah figure, you know, there's many Torah figures, those who we learned about recently, who become Jewish names, who have very questionable behaviors, right? We talked about Saul, who tried to kill David, and we talked about King Solomon, Shlomo, who towards the end of his life, you know, his kingship is removed from him because he either allows people to worship idols or doesn't stop them or whatever. So
in his own harem.
Yeah, right. So, and yet they don't lose their status as being Jewish heroes and having Jewish names. So, we retain
Shaul
names.
Shaul is considered a Tzaddik, despite all his flaws.
That's what I'm saying. So, when it comes to defining who a wicked person is, that's not an easy thing to do. Because, you know, Yehuda has his stories, and, you know, they all have their stories. All the brothers sold Yosef, and they're still popular Jewish names. And so, it's hard to define who is wicked. So first, there's two things. Is the Torah is people in the Torah who are wicked. And then, let's say you have a family member who did some questionable things in their life, but they're your grandparents, or they're your great-grandparents. And do you necessarily want a name after them? Sometimes if you know too much about people, there's always something that you wonder, maybe they're not the best person to name a child after. So Rav Moshe Feinstein did get this question, and he said that as long as, if it's a popular, common enough Jewish name, then you can use it. You know, if it's Avraham, Avraham is Avraham. Like, you know, okay, so, you know, your grandfather's name is Avraham, and you want to name the kid Avraham, but it's not like naming the kid Lavan. But if you, if you're really concerned that, you know, but look, you know, I know cases like this where, you know, I've gotten questions like this where my grandfather did so and so, and I loved my grandfather and I respected my grandfather, but he did so and so, right? He was sent to jail, or I know that he was kind of a crook, or I know that he cheated on my grandmother, or whatever it is, you know, like, they know too much. So, but at the same time, he was also good, and I loved him, we had a good relationship, so what do you do? So, what some people do, I think what Moshe says, is so add a name to it, right? If his name was Avraham, or so name your kid Avraham Shmuel, or Avraham whatever. So, if you add a name, it changes the name a little bit, so it's not the same exact name, and that's kind of a way to get around it, if you're concerned about that. Yeah.
That raises a little bit of a question. So it's even more common to actually do two-part Hebrew names. Are there any guidelines for that?
No, I mean, there's some who think Kabbalistically it's not a good idea to name one child after two different people. Mm-hmm. Some, you know, I know when. There's some people think that's like a bad thing to do because it's too much going on in one little person, in one person. You know, there's different personality. I don't know. So it depends how mystical and how kind of superstitious you are a little bit. When it comes to names, I think people.
There's one person, not two people.
What?
There's one person, not
two. To name a kid. You know, Yaakov Shimon. Yaakov was my grandfather, and Shimon was my wife's grandfather. You know, to not do that. So some people think to add a name, just like because you like a name, that's fine. I mean, that's just like adding something new to it. So it doesn't really matter if you have one or two names or three or four names. But the only thing that I think that comes up is as having two different, one kid named after two different people. Yeah. What do you think?
She agrees.
Yeah.
She adores watching the rabbi speak. And Shaul, she's always like...
I do well with people who don't understand me. That's my best audience.
Well, I know my Hebrew name is Miriam Dina. And when I told that to someone, they said, we have a custom in our family not to name any of the children after people who bad things happen to.
Oh, so we get to that. That's next. Okay, that's next. What about someone? Why is that what happened? Someone we named after someone who something bad happened
Dina?
To.
The daughter.
Oh, Dina from the Torah story.
Yeah.
Oh gosh! Oh wow! Again, find someone who nothing bad happened to.
well, I mean. It's
no, seriously.
Pretty bad.
I mean, Leah. Well, Leah wasn't loved. Rachel died young. I mean,
Dina Gertenberg.
Yeah, I mean, I'm saying, well, but there is so the Sefer Hasidim does. Quote a custom, but not naming after someone who died young, right? Let's say you had a relative who died young, so some say it's like a bad mazel to name a child after someone who died young. If they had bad mazel, why do you want to kind of put that on your child? What does it mean to die young? So Well, so Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky says anyone dies under the age of 60, the Minchas Eliezer, anyone dies under the age of 50, so it's not so clear. The Ramah though says, so the Ramah quotes this, and he says that that we do use the name Gedaliahu. Right, Gedaliahu is Gedalia, who was assassinated young.
But he didn't die yet, he was killed.
He was killed. So we use that name. So what distinction does that make? So it could be that we make a distinction of someone who died al Kiddush Hashem, right? Somebody who died in sanctification of God's name. So most practically, you name after someone who died in the Holocaust, right? And how many people, when they survived the war, wanted to name their child after their 7-year-old sibling who died, who was killed by the Nazis? So is that considered to be a bad omen? So this would seem to say that no, that's not a bad omen. That's to be able to name a child after someone like that, that could be a very special thing. That's not considered someone who died young. Someone who died young was bad mazel, could be they got sick, whatever it is, something they died unnaturally in a way that was not al Kiddush Hashem. But someone who died
like cancer.
What?
Maybe they got cancer.
Yeah.
It's a bad mazel for sure.
Well, yeah. So
could you generally make the counter argument that if they die young, even if this is something like cancer, that naming the child is kind of making up to it to some extent?
Yeah. Yeah, again, we're dealing with like very ephemeral things and customs and, you know.
What about levirate marriage? Because the baby born from a levirate marriage is supposed to continue the name
of the father.
The dead father.
Get the name of the father. That's a good question. That's a very good question.
So wouldn't they name him after
it? Typically, you'd think, yeah. Maybe they'd add a name or something to it. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know.
We have a coin, you saw.
What?
Mr. Stein.
Yeah, no, people, that happens all the time. Okay. So again, this is Kabbalistic kind of stuff, but it's something that people are aware of. Rav Moshe says, Rav Moshe Feinstein, he says that it's hard to really determine what dying young means. He said there's a feel to it. There's a sense of someone who died young, a sense of someone who lived an incomplete life. It could be that they died, from a sickness young, they died unnaturally in a car accident or something, so there's a sense of when, because someone could live 55 years and have lived a very full life, and there's someone who could have lived 55 years and there's a sense that they died really young, and there's a lot they, so I don't know. He said it's hard to really define. If you're really concerned, then you add a name to it and,
Wasn't there a big medieval sadi who died at 40?
The Ari.
Okay.
The Ari's all died before the age of 40.
Yeah.
The Ramah.
But he...
I'm not sure.
Ari Kaplan died
very young, yeah.
The Ramah.
But the Ari's all died in his 30s, yeah.
But he got a lot accomplished, in a sense. So, is that considered dying young, or did he get enough accomplished that is?
Yeah, no, and there's a certain sense that some people, Hashem intends to grant short life, King David was seen as someone who died at 70, but it seemed like he, could have lived longer. But Shlomo, Shmuel and Shlomo, they died at the age of 52, right? So is that young? Well, yes and no. It's young, relatively speaking, but they accomplished a lot and lived very rich lives. So it's hard to quantify. It's very hard to quantify. But you're right. I mean, I was thinking about the Arizal because he's, and there's many other examples like that.
The Ramah, I think. Isn't
what?
The Ramah.
I think I don't remember exactly what age, but yeah, I think I agree. Yeah, I think he died young. So,
because isn't there also a Kabbalistic concept that people are put here to complete something? So
yeah, no, it's
and if they complete it, then
there could be people who are put here to die young, and there could be here, what happens when a child dies, or a child's born with Tay-Sachs disease or whatever it is, so. That seems that some
genetic testing first.
Yeah, no, I know, but it happens all the time. So
that was a great Kiddush Hashem when they started that for Orthodox Jews.
For sure.
You know,
for Ashkenazi Jews, yeah.
That was murdered in India, Mumbai.
Right.
Yeah,
they did.
Yeah, a couple had type.
Oh, yeah?
They're both looking at
it. Yeah, that if you kids are taste sex, I think, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. That's a shame. They should have it tested.
All right, so this is very timely. The next thing we'll talk about is the Shalom Zachar, which we'll have this Friday night for the Guttenbergs, who had a baby boy today.
Oh, yay! Yeah. I talked to somebody today and they asked me.
Yeah, they had a baby boy today, so...
How big?
I don't know, I just...
He'll be in a show tomorrow?
We texted, what?
He's going to be in a show tomorrow?
Well, I don't know. Maybe. We'll see.
Shabbos, probably.
Shabbos. Oh, yeah. So what is the Shalom Zachor? So a few ideas about what Shalom Zachor is. So the Shalom Zachor first is an Ashkenazi custom. It's not a Sephardic custom. Sephardim don't have Shalom Zachors.
Well, they do things similar, but a different day.
You would think that Sephardim would have a Shalom
Zachor. They just yell at each other. What?
No, they do. It's almost like the exact same thing, but it's the night before the bris.
Right. They do something, right. They do a Hilula, I think. Or that's for a wedding.
I don't know what it's called.
There's something they do the night before the bris, right? Right.
Yeah, Shalom Zachor.
Chassidim do it too a lot there. So it's based on the Ramah. The Ramah says that there is a custom to have a Sudas mitzvah, a meal for a mitzvah, the first Friday night after the child is born, after a baby boy is born. So why is that so? Why only for a boy? So the Taz, one of the commentaries in the Shulchan Aruch, writes, to mourn the fact that the child just forgot the entire Torah, right? He says it's a meal of mourning, because the child, as the Midrash says, child learns the entire Torah in the womb, and then right before the child comes out, an angel comes in, taps the child over the lip, and that's why we have this little indentation over the lip. That's the Midrash, from the angel's touch, and the child forgets the entire Torah. So we're mourning that. That's what he says. There's something cute that's tied into this a little bit. So, how do you say male in Hebrew?
Man.
Zachar.
Zachar.
So that's your question?
No, I'll wait for everybody else.
Okay.
You liked me too.
That's true. I do like you to wait. Okay, so...
is that a Zion or is that a Gimel? I get mixed up. As a Zion.
No, think of that. Gimel is like it's almost like a G.
It's opposite. That's the reason I get mixed up.
Like Gimel's the other way.
Yeah.
Okay, so Zachor is male, right? And female is Nekeva. Okay, so there's two things that we're told to do to commemorate the Shabbos. What do we do? We're told...
Zachor.
Right, there's Shamor and Zachor. So, and there's two versions of the Ten Commandments in the Torah. One of the versions say we should Shamor at Shabbat, and the other one says Zachor at Yom HaShabbat.
Make it manly.
What?
Make it manly.
Right, so Shamor means to keep the laws, right? To keep the laws.
Observe.
To observe or to keep, which refers to the negative commandments, meaning don't light a fire, don't cook, don't...
Murder.
Well, no. This is just for Shabbos.
Oh.
Talk about Shabbos.
You can never murder, yeah. Meaning, it's the don't do's of Shabbos. Zachor, or is to remember the Shabbos, and that means to do the positives of Shabbos. To say Kiddush, to have meals, to do all the good things you do on Shabbos. So, Rabbi Yaakov Emden makes a connection of these two words, since male and remember are the same exact letters. So he says we have a male meal, a meal of remembrance, quote unquote. So that's the kind of the connection of why we do this on Friday night, is because these words are connected. What's the connection between these two words? So, one way you can look at it is to say that on Shabbos we're supposed to remember, and now we're helping this child remember the Torah. Okay, and that becomes a big focus that a lot of people have on the Shalom Zachor. It's again focused on this midrash that the child, you know, they're touched on the lip and they forget all the Torah. So now it's like a reminder that now it's our job to help the child remember the Torah by teaching it. Okay, so the Shalom Zachor is to remember, is a night of remembrance. And it's basically a sense of responsibility collectively that now we have to educate this child, right? this child has forgotten the Torah. Now we have to remind the child of the Torah.
So they do that by getting drunk.
They do this by getting drunk. Yeah, pretty much. And eating
cake. If you try to make him remind, remember all the Torah, then he has to remember all the Machlokes.
Yeah. What do you mean?
Okay, that's fine.
So it's supposed to be a night of Torah. It's supposed to be a night of Torah, ideally. It's celebration, but it's also a night of Torah. So the Alshech says, one of the Rishonim says that the part of the remembrance that we're talking about here. Yeah, thank you. We have other references to this as well, right? That the Talmud says that every Jew was at Mount Sinai, right? All our souls were at Mount Sinai. So why are all our souls at Mount Sinai? Well, even those who are not alive yet, why is that necessary? Even those who are going to convert in the future, why is that necessary? It shows us that we have our predetermined chelek of the Torah, our predetermined portion of the Torah. And just like, you know, we're taught the Torah and then we're made to forget it, it's to teach us that we have already our place in the Torah, our relationship with the Torah. Now we just have to get back to it, right? It's almost like if you found out at the age of 18 that you were adopted, and you would have this need to find out, you know, where do I come from? Who's my family? Where do I fit in? We have a sense that we want to know how we fit in. Oh, gotcha. I hope I'm not getting my kids cold now.
Two.
Two of them had colds the last couple days. I've just been waiting for it to get to me, and now it's hitting. Anyway.
Did they get in Vegas?
Whatever happens when it stays in Vegas, the cold should have stayed there, so I don't know how they'll come with us. I don't know. Who knows how these things happen?
I think it's the plane doesn't help.
Yeah, I'd like
to. So the point is that our job is not to learn the Torah as much as it is to remember the Torah. It's to remember what we learned. It's to remember that we already have a connection, a place in the Torah.
But a woman, is she really high to learn Torah?
That's why it's for men, is because since men have an obligation to learn Torah, this is connected to the male obligation of learning Torah.
But also,
so it's a reminder to the men.
Women also have this like class.
Well, you know, they're still obligated to learn Torah, just not the same obligation. So the idea is that it's reminding the men who are there to that they have themselves a chelek, a portion in the Torah that they have to be learning, and that they're collectively responsible to remind this child, to teach this child about his place in the Torah as well. So I think that's a nice way of looking at Shalom Zachor. A community gets together to kind of tell each other, okay, that we're collectively responsible for the education of this child. And I think that's a nice way of looking at it. So just to complete this picture, so what do we do on Shabbos? We say Kiddush. Why do we say Kiddush on Shabbos? Well, what's the purpose of saying Kiddush on Shabbos? So it's to announce Shabbos, right? It's to make... I was just talking about the Hebrew school kids. You know, it's like when the President of the United States is about to speak, so how does it always start, right? So there's the voice that says, ladies and gentlemen, please rise, please welcome the President of the United States, right? Why isn't he just waiting there at the podium when the camera turns on? Why? Because, you know, there's a...
It doesn't show sufficient respect.
Yeah, right. When you're announced and you're introduced, there's a sign of respect that, you know, we need to welcome you in, we need to introduce you, right? There's an added sign of respect to it. So Shabbos as well, Shabbos happens automatically. The seventh day comes. If we don't say Kiddush, it's still Shabbos. It doesn't mean it's not Shabbos. But Kiddush is our way of introducing, announcing Shabbos, right? The way we would do, you know, with anyone that's respectful. So Zachor, we're told to remember the Shabbos. It means, yes, the seventh day will come anyway, but you're obligated to actively remember Shabbos. You're actively introducing Shabbos. You're making a big deal out of Shabbos. So that's why it says to remember it, because even though it's going to happen, even though it's already there, it's your job to actively do something about it. So that's compared to education, that even though the child learned the Torah, quote-unquote, in the womb, it's your job to bring it out. Even though we're all given a portion of the Torah, we have to bring it out of ourselves. So that's another kind of a further step of connecting it, that just as we have to remember the Shabbos actively, we have to remember the Torah actively. By learning it, by being involved in it, don't just assume it's going to be there just because, our souls were at Mount Sinai, or we still have to do something about it. Any questions on this?
So, a little off the topic of the names, but sure. How is Kiddush announcing Shabbat different than Kabbalah Shabbat?
Kabbalah Shabbat is very similar concept. It's not as formal, but it is a very similar concept. It's really, Kabbalah Shabbat is about accepting Shabbat upon yourself. You're welcoming Shabbat at its outset. Kiddush can be done a little later. It's at some point in the night of, you should be doing it. It doesn't have to happen right away. But yeah, it's a very similar concept. Yeah, I agree.
Before you eat.
Yeah. Okay. All right, good. So so we'll stop here, and we will pick up. So next week we have...